I'd like to call to order the Planning and Development Committee, 12:30 PM meeting. Our first item or second item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from the November 2nd.
Move for approval.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Ayes have it. Item number three is public comments. Is there anyone here for public comment? If so, you have 2 minutes. State your name and address for the record.
Hello, I'm LRB Dargan at 1454 North Point Lane, and I just wanted to speak in favor of the rezoning request for North Point. We've long been in this kind of gray area where if we want to do projects that need approval, the town can't really say yes or no because it's a planned development, but without the normal planned development standards. And I think that this effort here does a good job of meeting everyone's goals. I know last time this came before the committee or the council, there was a concern about subdividing and making new lots, and this plan will prohibit that while also allowing the town to, you know, evaluate requests. So anyway, I think it's a good thing for myself and the other homeowners in the neighborhood, and I hope that you'll approve it. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here for public comment? All right, public comment is now closed. Moving on to the next item on the agenda is annexation requests.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good afternoon. This first request is an annexation for 1619 Highway 41. It's approximately a 1-acre tract of land located in the Phillips community. You can see it right here in an aerial next to the Sun Chaser development. Our new comp plan does recommend the settlement community land use for this area. With the new comp plan and our current zoning code, this will automatically come in as R1. That's still something that we're working on. Typically or historically, it would have come in as community conservation. So it will automatically come in as R1. You can see in the zoning map, all of the hatched area is all county land still, and then the adjacent development is community conservation. And that's all I have unless you have any questions. It is also a vacant piece of property at this point in time.
Yes, for sale.
Do we have any motion?
I'll move for approval.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion?
My only discussion is, do we have any idea what they want to do with that property other than a single-family house?
That would be my guess. I'm not aware of anything else.
Yeah, because it's for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you put up property for sale, it is subject to desire for rezoning, so that's why I was curious if there'd been any overtures in that direction.
Not my discussions. At 1 acre, they could perhaps get up to 3 units per acre without, they would have to meet all of the development standards, but just looking at the layout, the dimensions, it would be challenging to subdivide this and meet all the R1 requirements.
And there is a parcel adjacent, south of it, adjacent to, is it Penders or something like that street?
Yes, sir.
So that could be an access point.
Could be.
But they'd have to go through and acquire that other property.
Correct.
Is that it? All right, thank you. All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? For a recommendation to full council to do the annexation. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No, ayes have it. Item number five, review of Planning Commission recommendations from the December 16th, 2020 meeting. The first thing's rezoning.
Okay, this is a request before you to amend the plan development ordinance for North Point. This was created many years ago. It was an annexed and zoned PD, but there was never a corresponding ordinance with it, so there was no text, no map establishing uses or development standards. And so over the years, this has been a concern, both with town staff having to answer inquiries and with the property owners. And so we're here today to hopefully fix that moving forward. As you can see, it is located off Ben Sawyer Boulevard. here's our new future land use map. So it's designated for traditional residential neighborhood, and it's also part of a community scale hub. And so the PD with those mixed uses is certainly appropriate for this area. And there you can see that it is zoned PD. Over the years, as I said, folks have, a number of folks have inquired about what they could do with their property. So we would often tell them, you know, if they want to do an addition or something to that effect, what would be our setbacks? And we couldn't tell them. There weren't any setbacks established for the neighborhood. And so we've had a few come in and rezoned R4, as you can see on the zoning map. And then we had a dental office come in and rezone to office professional so that they could establish standards. What's before you today does not include those already rezoned parcels. The PD amendment really has no bearing on them. It would give them no benefit or detriment to what they're already zoned. So we decided to kind of leave those out of it and just to deal with the properties within the PD. And so that's what's before you now. As you recall, there was an earlier request earlier this year to rezone to R4. Town Council had concerns about further subdivision in this development. Because the request was to R4, the lot was rather large. It was, I think, about an acre. And so there were concerns about the applicant going to R4. And while he only wished to do an addition, there was no plans to do any subdivision. The request was denied, and staff was directed to kind of deal with this comprehensively instead of piecemeal bringing these rezonings in. And so we took some time. We looked at the all of the lots within the development. And we started looking at if we were to rezone each lot based on its lot size. Most of them were going to be R4. We were going to have a few R1s, a few R2s. It was becoming really cumbersome, and we thought, you know, typically with a PD, we don't encourage PDs because they can get difficult to deal with over the years, but we thought if there was ever a case for a PD, this is it. This is truly a mixed-use neighborhood. It's got office professional, single-family detached. It's got townhouses. And so we felt like, why not keep the PD designation, just establish some basic standards? And so that's what we did. And to keep it simple, we just wrote in that all single-family detached would be subject to our R4 standards. The townhouses would be subject to our townhouse standards. The office professional would be subject to our OP standards. And then there is a Dominion Energy property, formerly SCE&G, that right on the corner there that would be subject to our public institutional one standards. And so that's what we provided in the PD documents, literally like a page. And then we also put a provision in there that they could not further subdivide any lots without coming back to you all and town council with a further amendment. So that's what's before you today. It really doesn't change anything else. It just cleans it up, makes it clear. Folks that own property in there, they know what they're development standards are subject to, and we don't have to keep bringing these in property by property. So I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Do we have any questions?
My only question is, what did the Planning Commission have to say about this?
The Planning Commission did. I'm sorry, sir.
No, just about the comprehensive work on this PD.
Mm-hmm. They were happy with it. They didn't see any problems, and they recommended approval unanimously.
Right. I'll move for approval.
You have a motion? Do you have a second?
Second.
You have a motion and a second? I would just like to say that thank you so much for all your hard work on this. This has been an area that has concerned me, the fact that it was a PD with no ordinance with any sort of standards. So I think this is really cleaning things up in the town, so thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Nope. All right. Item number B on the agenda has been deferred to our February meeting. This is a rezoning from R3 to townhouse. Moving on to item, do we need to approve that deferral or no? It's just been deferred, right?
I think just having it on the record is sufficient.
Okay. Do we have a motion to approve the deferral?
I'll move to defer.
Okay. Do we have a second? Any discussion? All in favor?
My only discussion is, has this been to Planning Commission?
It did go to Planning Commission, and as you can see, they recommended denial 8-1.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point that between Commission and today that the applicant requested a deferral while they continue to work with the Bayview community.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
All right, motion passes, it's deferred to next month. Item number C is a zoning code text amendment.
Yes, ma'am, this is really just another fix from staff's perspective. It came to our attention when Dominion Energy has a property at 1277 Chuck Dolly Boulevard. It historically was used as an office, people would come in and pay their bills and that sort of thing. And over time, it has evolved into more of a maintenance facility. And so they came in and started having meetings with us about what could we do with this property? What does the current zoning allow? And, you know, what do we need to do to get to this point to make everything legal and conforming? And so essentially what we discovered through that process was that our principal use table, we have this section of government facilities, and then underneath that we have utilities. And for government facilities, we have an allowance for a lay down yard, a maintenance facility, and open lot storage, but we didn't have that for utilities. So if you had a private utility or quasi-governmental utility, they couldn't use that same provision based on the principal use table. And so this by no means allows Dominion to move forward with what they want to do. What it does is allows them to request a rezoning to PI2 because they're currently zoned AB. And if they do get rezoned, then this same provision that's allowed for government facilities would be available to them also as a private utility. And so what we've done is just make it permitted in PI2 and light industrial, the same as if it were a government facility. And as I said, they're currently zoned AB, and we talked to them and we said, if you concurrently, we'll work on a text amendment to fix our end if you choose to move forward with a rezoning. If you don't, then we fix the ordinance. And they actually applied for January. So they'll be requesting a rezoning. But this is really kind of separate and it needed to be cleaned up anyway. So.
All right. Do we have any, we have a motion to approve. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Ms. Hyatt?
Aye. Question. You said this is in line with what they plan to do. Have they mentioned why?
So they sent a conceptual plan to our design review team about what they would like to do. As I said, it's no longer used as an office, and they've sort of slowly started storing things on site and using it more as a maintenance type use. When they realized that wasn't really in line with what the current zoning was, they talked to us about what they could do to remedy that, to make the necessary improvements. And so we talked about their options, and that was to request a rezoning to PI2, and we would concurrently as staff try to fix this end of the ordinance. But their plan is to request a rezoning and to use that property as a more of a maintenance facility. So that would be kind of a separate process. You'll see it next month.
So technically they could just tear the building down if it doesn't suit and put something else there, use it as a lay down yard or for truck parking or anything like that?
Only if their rezoning is approved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, moving on to item D, zoning code text amendment for non-conforming uses.
Okay. So we've been looking at this for a while. We finally went for a public hearing last month, and we're bringing it back to you. Just a little bit of history. Back in March, we did an introduction, talked about the issues, some potential changes. July 30th, we talked about doing a refresher and a do-over. We decided we didn't just want to focus on unforeseen hazards and those sorts of things, but we wanted to look at the entire nonconformities ordinance as a whole. In August, we did the preliminary framework and outline. We took that to Planning Commission. We talked about it. And then September 23rd, we presented our changes specific to damage and destruction. We were going to move forward separately, but we decided, again, we needed to take a more holistic approach to the nonconformities. And that's what's before you today. It did go to Planning Commission. They recommended approval unanimously with some changes, and I'll talk about those at the end of this. So just a recap, historically, the nonconforming ordinance was really kind of an all or nothing approach. It was sort of a your only tool in the toolbox was a hammer, and the idea was you need to get rid of all your non-conforming uses. There's a trend now towards a kind of a more softer common sense approach in that you can treat some of these things a little bit differently based on what makes them non-conforming. And so that's kind of what we wanted to do, is kind of update this whole ordinance and make it a little bit more softer approach. So that's what we've done. An overview, as with a typical ordinance, we have our purpose and intent, our provisions. We talk about each type of change that could occur to affect this ordinance. We've added a degree of compliance based on nonconformity. It's class 1, 2, and 3. Special considerations, our appeal process, and then we've added some definitions. And so I've just pulled out some slides here to kind of hit on where we have comments next to them, and then I think you have a copy of the entire ordinance. But really the impetus for this whole draft, this whole ordinance change, if you'll recall, was Sullivan's Point. We had some changes in our ordinance. We've had some non-conforming properties, and property owners had concerns. If there was a hurricane or a fire, what happens to me? And so you'll recall, we ended up putting that development back in the overlay, but what we wanted to do was deal with non-conforming issues as a whole throughout the town and not just development by development. So we've got legal non-conformities and we've got illegal situations. And what we wanted to do is, there is no illegal non-conforming. If you're non-conforming, you are legal. And if you're illegal, you're just illegal. There is no such thing. So we really kind of want to make those distinctions in this text. We added a new section, a nonconformity created by government action. So for instance, if DOT comes in and wants to take some right-of-way or anything like that, we didn't want that burden to lay on the property owner and create a hardship for them. And so this is an exemption where the property owner is held harmless if some sort of government action has left their property nonconforming. The calculation amount of damage, right now our current ordinance talks about the reasonable replacement value. And what we require in our current ordinance is that they have to get an appraisal and figure out what it was worth before the damage. And so what we wanted to do is make it more simple. The county tax assessor already has this information on the Charleston County webpage. So you can go there, figure out what you're assessed at, and that's the figure that we want to be able to use. It's straightforward, it's available, it doesn't cost anything. And so that's a change with how we'd like to do the calculation of the amount of damage. Again, the degree of noncompliance, we've taken a different approach this time and given three classes. So class one, you would have your use of land. So you think about if I have a commercial use and well, let's say I have an industrial use and I've had some development next to me that's residential, and there's been some changes in the ordinance and that industrial use is no longer conforming. We may want to consider a more direct approach or a harder approach, use the hammer and get rid of that use that may be completely incompatible with a residential use. Whereas if the use is not incompatible, but say there's just limited parking or things like that. So we wanted to look at it in terms of, it's a use that may be more, that's on the hierarchy of things. That's going to be one of the bigger things that you may want to get rid of, that you may want to eliminate and make your uses conforming. Our class two was our buildings and structures, and we broke that out by principal versus accessory. So for instance, your principal building may be non-conforming with a setback, and that may be a little more dealt with a little bit differently than perhaps your accessory unit. And so that's class two, and then class three is your site feature. And that's on this page. And so what we tried to do is look at within the hierarchy of the classes, we've got these site features laid out. So you've got parking, stormwater, landscaping, screening, sidewalks, lighting, and those sorts of things. So for instance, we wanted to look at if you have a, you know, we've had this come up recently. We have the Cracker Barrel, we have the O2 Fitness. We have these properties that want to redevelop. They want to put new uses in there, but they may not necessarily meet all the requirements of our current ordinance. We want to be able to look at and say, instead of saying, nope, you don't meet the ordinance, you know, you can't make any improvements, you got to go away, we'd like to be able to look and say, okay, well, what makes you non-conforming? Are you missing one parking space? Are you missing a sidewalk? We want to be more flexible so that instead of having these large, empty, vacant buildings, we're working with folks to get businesses going, and we can kind of be flexible and deal with these minor nonconformities, or class three, if you will. And so this is a totally new section. This is a new approach, and we've seen it done in some other municipalities. And so so this is the main part here, in addition to the unforeseen damage versus neglect, those sorts of things that we've talked about over the months. We also wanted to add a provision for mobile homes. Oftentimes we get property annexed in from the county, and it's within the settlement communities, folks would want to remove an old mobile home and replace it with a new one, and they may have come in as R1, and R1 doesn't allow mobile homes, so they would have to rezone their property just to replace a mobile home. So we wanted to allow provision for folks that are annexed into the county, given an automatic zoning designation, and allow that provision for them to replace an existing mobile home. And so that's what that's there for. And then third exception is special area plans. So if you think about, we already have an exception for historic area. So this exception could deal with special areas like the settlement communities or Shem Creek area. So in other words, right now the overall non-conforming ordinance applies to every area throughout the town, but say for instance we come in later and we're planning on doing a special area plan for just Shem Creek, where we deal with the zoning and nonconformities, then this section would you would go to that special area overlay in order to deal with nonconformity. So we wanted to allow those deviations from this ordinance in the instance that our future zoning code has special area zoning code plans. And then we have our appeal process, like everything else with our zoning code. There's a determination made, and anybody can appeal to the Board of Zoning Appeals, so that's very similar to everything else. As I said, Planning Commission recommended approval. They did have some things that they wanted us to look at revising. One of those is just to make sure all the terms throughout the ordinance were consistent with definitions. Obviously, as you can see, when you get to talking about nonconformities, legal, illegal, a lot of times we get so busy talking about it and using different terms, we think of them as being the same, and so it got a little confusing. So we do want to make sure we have all of our terms consistent with our definitions. Also, the five-year cumulative provision, the recommendation was to move that from a section C4 to D to C5, and that made sense with regards to the 50% rule. And then last, just providing some clarifying language as to how section C and D interrelate. For instance, if somebody were just to look at section C, they may automatically assume that section D doesn't apply to them. And so just making sure that this is easy to the reader, keeping it simple and easy to understand, and making sure it flows properly to the public. There was also a couple of recommendations that staff is still looking at. It was mentioned by Planning Commission that it may be too long, 14 pages. Perhaps you could remove the intent or something. And so we're looking at that, those little things. But that's really all I have before you. I'm happy to answer any questions. I know that's a lot of information, but.
All right. Community, do you have any questions?
Yes, ma'am, I have one. This idea of deleting the 50% provision, mm-hmm. when it is irrelevant.
Well,
can you explain that?
Yeah. So if you looked at the text that we presented to Planning Commission, the draft text, we had the under damage due to neglect. If you'll recall, months ago, the whole purpose of this was to deal with properties damaged due to hazards, natural hazards versus neglect. And we had left in that 50% rule under damage due to neglect, and it really didn't apply in the same manner as it did to doing improvements or additions or unforeseen hazards. And so it just made sense to not have it under that section, and that was the comment.
Explain to me why it doesn't make sense to have it.
Well, because we are establishing different standards for damage due to neglect. So if your property is damaged due to neglect, the Planning Commission felt like the 50% rule should not apply. Again, this was a Planning Commission recommendation.
Okay.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand is we wanted to shift incentives, right? We didn't want people, we don't want people to neglect their properties.
No.
To reach, so,
right.
So I guess I'm trying, I think I'm with Mr. Chapman. I'm trying to understand how that is.
Well, it was a Planning Commission recommendation.
Okay.
That the 50% doesn't apply to, damage due to neglect. So this is, we presented it as we had drafted it. These were Planning Commission's recommended changes. I can't speak for why they felt like it shouldn't be there, but it just had to do with the 50% rule. And these are some things that we're still looking at. I mean, staff would like a little more time to review these Planning Commission recommendations and make sure they make sense. And again, have legal make sure it all makes sense as well. So these are just, again, these were Planning Commission recommendations. And so we want to incorporate those into the PowerPoint, and we want to incorporate those moving forward if they make sense.
You know, yeah, I think the best course of action, this is my thought, is to bring this back next month once you've had a little bit more time to look at it, and we've had a little bit more time to delve into it, because this is, these are some significant changes. I know that this has been on the agenda for a long time, and we've been trying to address this non-conforming issue. And this addition of the tiers of things, I think this is something that we need a little bit more time to delve deeper into.
Yes,
is everyone comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we'll just bring it back next month.
Right.
All right, thank you.
Ma'am.
Item number six, this is just an update on the building permit allocation system and the multifamily housing moratorium.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Yes, Town Administrator's Office asked us to give you an update on where we stand with these two different ordinances. So we'll divide it out into two pieces. First would be the permit allocation system, and then we'll talk about the moratorium that was put in place in 2019. So this system of metering out permits for residential development was made effective in January of 2019, and it was a five-year program. And so it was set up and geared, if those of you that were on the council, to sort of try to achieve a annual average 2% growth rate, which seemed reasonable during those discussions. We have a couple of different categories of residential dwelling unit types, and we allocate permits twice a year on a first-come, first-served basis for single-family and accessory dwelling units. Multifamily was set up as in a different way, where there was one allocation of 500 total apartment, condo, multifamily units. That was on a first served basis, so it wasn't, that one wasn't set up to be divvied out every 6 month period. You couldn't accumulate permits in order to build a 200 unit apartment complex if you had to wait and go. So that was set up on purpose to operate that way. You'll recall that two of our developments have development agreements which predate the ordinance. So Liberty Hill Farms and Carolina Park are not subject to this permit system. What happens when these units or allocations are not utilized? They roll over into the next period. And the staff in our building inspections unit, they have administered now four of these six-month allocation periods. And so we've done two of the total 5 years of this system, and we just wanted to share with you how those things are looking. So if you go to the totals, single family over the 5 years was set up for 2,400 total single family, 100 accessory dwelling units, and the 500 multifamily units that I mentioned. And you could see within each six-month period, starting from adoption through June 30th, the number of allocations that were issued. You see permit two, period two, excuse me. So in year one, the grand total was 791. And you see it's kind of front-loaded then as we move into the next. No multifamily units were then allocated in year two, in periods three and four, because they were all spoken for in the first year. And so you have, again, these permits that are getting carried over year to year. And we thought a better way to show you how this works is this chart, which gives you the feeling for, in the orange up the upper left, we have an allocation. This is just for single family, so you see how it operates. 118 of the 240 were issued. That left 122. That gets carried over, added to the 240, et cetera, as you move through these six-month allocation periods. And at this point, with moving into year three, which would be now, January 1, 2021, and this first allocation period, which is number five, we would carry over 324 single-family permits from the prior 2 years, get added to the 240 that are set up to be available in this next six-month period, with a grand total then of 564 available. So what does that mean in terms of... see if this works. Yeah. Set up with a clicker. Well, maybe it'll go there. Here we go. Works differently here. So backing up again and give you a feeling for single family again. We had 240, 118 issued in that first 6 month period. Then we start moving up and accumulating, and you can see over time the issuance of permits in the lower part of the graph in the dark blue, and you see what's happening as the number of available single family allocations are growing at a faster pace than what we're actually issuing. So this is where we stand today with 564 single families available for starting with year three and moving through the rest. So some observations that we have for you are that this plan is going according to plan. So the staff has figured out and we're managing how to run the system. We brought this one up in the past before. We continue to exceed demand on accessory dwelling units. We talked about increasing that supply maybe a year or so ago. Council opted not to do that. So we have folks that are on a waiting list. You get put in a queue and you may be waiting till the beginning of a subsequent six-month period before we could issue a permit. We are receiving many inquiries for additional multifamily units, and we explained that this is the program that we're operating under, and their option is to go elsewhere or wait and see what happens in the future. One other provision that we have is that we're concerned about certain developments taking up, you know, all of the permits. And we put a limit in the ordinance that says you can have 25 permit limit by development. And I think, unfortunately, we sort of define that as like by name, the whole Dunes West area, the whole Park West area. And we've run into, in December actually, a situation where one developer in all of Dunes West spoke for the 25 that's available. Now others are on the waiting list. And that may be a piece that we would rather take another look at and suggest that those limits be placed on a smaller geographic area, like an actual name of a subdivision, rather than a general, I mean, if you did it under the Old Village, for instance, versus the name of a subdivision within there. And so that's something that if you're interested in, we can look at further. So at this point, no other applications in Dune West can be reviewed until summertime. So anybody else, another developer within that name of that development is out of luck. And somebody has, you know, so it's sort of backfired on us in terms of how you might allocate the units there. But that's one that we wanted you to keep in mind. The other is amending the ordinance. We built in thinking that it would be considerable activity, and we'd want to be giving you updates as a council every 6 months, and we really haven't had to do that. It's been working fine. And so rather than having an ordinance provision in there that says we shall do, the planning director shall do a report every 6 months with no reason to do it, we think you could take it out, that requirement, and just ask for an update like this over time. And so what we would suggest is amending and clarifying that 25 permit limit on developments, and let us take a look at that one and maybe come back with a potential ordinance change that kind of addresses that a little bit better. So that's the permit allocation. In conjunction with that, we have a moratorium on multifamily dwellings, which in this case means apartments. That was established or reestablished April 9th, 2019, to replace the 2017 moratorium. And you're familiar with the history of how that was developed. And this action in 2019 just extended that. There are some exemptions. And we don't even process new applications if you can't meet the moratorium. And so that moratorium is set to expire in a couple of months. So this is advanced planning work to get you thinking about this particular topic. So some observations and recommendations here are that you have another tool that's already operating and effectively handling growth for residential on the residential side. And in terms of multifamily development apartments, there are only 10 permits of the 500 left for the remaining 3 years. And so the other aspect of this is that when you enact a moratorium, you have to be or should be working on something to fix a problem in your ordinance that's not, you know, that needs cleaning up or adjusting or changing. We're not doing that at this point. And so you have some legal considerations that you may want to take into account. And so our suggestion would be, because you have the permit allocation system, which is handling this for you, you could consider letting that moratorium, the second two-year moratorium, lapse in April and not re-up it, if you will, for another permit period. And David can talk to you about more about the legal aspects of that. And we did share a little brief article over the weekend that just gave you a perspective from the Municipal Association about how to deal with moratoria. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions or give you any other comments or observations that we've seen in managing these two programs.
All right, committee, do we have any thoughts or questions? Ms. Hyatt?
So the fact that we're planning to rewrite zoning code doesn't count as something we're working on that?
No, because of the nature of the moratorium was sort of as originally established, it was to while the town was working on impact fees and making changes, that we needed to slow things down to figure out what our impact fees were going to be. Well, that was done. So the basis for the moratorium was to buy you some breathing room to figure out sort of the rate or pace of growth. The zoning code, with all its other provisions, doesn't get at, you know, those particular aspects. This is sort of a separate ordinance.
You know, committee, if I think that maybe perhaps we should discuss this next month under executive session to receive legal advice regarding the parameters for moratoriums, and so that we have a good understanding of the legalities of moratoriums and potentially continuing our moratorium. Is that something that people are comfortable with?
Fine with me.
Mr. DeMora, does that sound good to you?
I was just going to recommend the same, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you. The building permit allocation system, I have thoughts on that. I feel that the six-month report, actually, I like the six-month report, and I think that it doesn't have to be an extensive, full-on presentation, but just like we receive an update on programs in rec department every single month with numbers, I think a six-month report just giving us an idea, because we can see, you know, the ADU permits are all getting snatched up pretty quickly, the single family is kind of tapering off, and the multifamily is limited. The other question I had was the exception for age-restricted housing, is there also an exception for affordable housing to the moratorium? Because that is something that I think that we should...
There are exceptions in...
There is already.
In the moratorium.
Okay.
So that's part of what we deal with. That's part of what we deal with these two, and they apply and deal with, for instance, the moratorium specifically deals with apartments, but the permit allocation, apartments and condos are considered multifamily. So we have different definitions and different classes, and trying to figure out how to apply both of those. And there are often times when we're scratching our heads and have to take a breather and go back and look and say, oh, wait a minute, let's refresh. Oh, okay, this is how this, in conjunction, the two mean this, or individually, one of them controls. So we can share more information about sort of those exceptions that are within there.
The permit allocation system, the exception, so you do not need to go through this system if you are building age-restricted housing or if you are building affordable housing. Are those the two categories that are exempt from the permit allocation and the moratorium?
Might be just affordable.
So permit allocation is just affordable, but moratorium is age restricted and not affordable. So I think maybe something that we could look at is maybe harmonizing that, so that we have, because I think that both age restricted and affordable is something that should be included in both as options for being behind the moratorium, because those are things that we need in the town.
Yeah, the moratorium has senior, so age restricted. The permit allocation addressed the affordable.
But they overlap.
Yes.
So, yes. Okay. So maybe
that could be part of the background that you look at next time.
Are there any thoughts from other council members on this? Mr. Chapman? No?
No.
Ms. Corley? Okay. Well, maybe we can take a look at this again next month with an executive session to discuss the moratorium. And then if we could bring back just maybe like a side-by-side chart of what the exceptions are to each, so that we could potentially take a look at amending the ordinances to harmonize that, so that there's a clearer picture for developers who are coming to town who would like to do things, that they can know the parameters of what would be permitted and what would not be permitted.
I like that.
Okay.
Right. And Madam Chairman, I would also like to see the number of houses in the two subdivisions that are not included in the moratorium. I'd like to see the numbers of those that are
going up,
being permitted and going mm-hmm. up, so that we've got an idea of the overall numbers that we're getting. Certainly, they've got an exemption, but there's still extra properties mm-hmm. that are going up. That gives us a better idea, I think, of how that moratorium is working or not working, to have them all shown, not just the ones for, I think it's Carolina Park.
And that's under the permit
Liberty
allocation
Hill.
System, not the moratorium. But
right.
Yes,
yeah,
we can give you the numbers on what's happening within Liberty Hill
right.
and Carolina Park, in addition to the numbers
yeah.
that you're seeing.
I haven't seen much going on in Liberty Hill, but a lot in Carolina Park.
They have, yeah, Liberty Hill is still working on early phases and
right.
construction.
Right.
Carolina Park, I think at the time we were thinking they might do around a little over 100 a year And I don't know what those numbers are, so we can definitely bring you back that info.
And do you think also maybe draft language about amending it to either a smaller geography or to particular developers for, like, either to a particular, because I think that situation in Dunes West where a single developer got all the permits, I think that we could maybe limit it to each developer gets 25 permits versus geography, or I don't know what would be best for that situation, but if something in that situation could help, because Dunes West is such an enormous development, and so is Carolina Park, so we want to spread the permits out. Okay. All right. Is there anything else on item number 6? Okay. Item number 7, preview. Historic property designations with the Old Village. This is something that Michelle gave me a heads up on this a little bit earlier. So now that we have changed our ordinance to enable properties that are on a rolling basis, the 1960s, I believe, are now included, in that there's a list of properties that are coming up. So Jeff, if you could give us.
Yes, thanks. So at your meeting next week, we have an advertised public hearing regarding possibly designating 38 additional properties within the Old Village Historic District as historic. This has been an item that has sort of been, we've been working on with various ordinance changes and the comp plan over the past couple of years. And we just wanted to give you a heads up in advance of that public hearing. We've been asked a lot, well, what are we hearing from property owners? You see here that, you know, folks that may be affected aren't here speaking at the your general comment period, but they may speak at your advertised public hearing. So by way of background, this dates back to 1979 when the town created a zoning district, a special overlay called the Old Village Historic District. And there's a lot of confusion typically in this area where people think that means a National Register Historic District, which it does not. This is zoning. And we actually do have a 1973, so a predecessor step was that a National Register Historic District was designated by the Secretary of the Interior, and that's now encompassed in the town's zoning district, which is slightly larger. And National Register designations are deemed or viewed more as sort of honorary. They don't carry a regulatory, there is no federal ordinance about how you develop or redevelop designated properties there. But in our local zoning district, the Old Village, the town is in control of development activity and it does carry weight. So here are the boundaries of the district itself. And what's shaded in the blue color for you are all the existing properties that are designated historic. So what we're looking to do would be to add 38 more to this particular map, and we'll show you what those would be. And here it is again on an aerial photo. So in yellow, which were the formerly the blue, those are designated historic properties. Now they sometimes we interchange structure with property, but sometimes it's the entire property of structure or a accessory structure might even be the thing that designates that entire parcel, that property, as historic. And so having this district comes with administrative responsibility, and what was called the Old Village Historic District, you'll recall, has been renamed to the Historic District Preservation Commission, HDPC. And that set them up for the long term where they could look at this district and any future districts that could be created in the town. They are an architectural review board. In other cities, you often hear that referred to. In Charleston, it's the ARB. And they screen development proposals looking at exteriors. They're not looking at the interior of structures to comply with zoning and guidelines. The staff can handle minor ones, but the HDPC looks at others. And what happens is a COA, a Certificate of Appropriateness permit, is issued once that review occurs before somebody then gets building permits to move forward. And those guidelines, and that's not the subject of this particular piece, but just, this is what most people recognize is what's happening in the Old Village. The guidelines are then applied, and they address all kinds of features like materials of structures, and we have standards and limits on, you know, what folks can do as they're renovating, rehabilitating, adding on. The other aspects, the commission has other responsibilities, one of which is the subject of this future discussion, and one of their duties is to determine and designate or make recommendations to council for properties that could be considered historic. And Chairman Whitley mentioned, we used to have a fixed date when the ordinance was initially adopted, and so anything before 1936 could be considered, but as time went on, nothing else. That was changed, and we now mirror the federal and state guidelines, and structures or properties 50 years or older could continually be assessed over time into the future, and additional properties could be designated historic. So using an inventory that we had from 2010, staff updated that information, and there were 158 total new properties that could have met that age qualification piece, and were on our prior inventory from about a decade ago. And those were all reviewed and presented to the commission, and staff gave recommendations on whether or not we thought it warranted a historic designation, or perhaps additions and changes had occurred that had eroded the historic value of that particular structure. And the commission recommends to you 38 more properties to be included as historic. And so you have a listing in the memo that we provided of the various properties and some examples here for you. And so if approved, the gold properties would then get added in to the total of those specific properties in designated historic. The others are still within the general district. And so together you would end up with the pink color being still not considered historic structures, but enveloped by the district itself. And they're sort of mixed in with all the contributing structures that are in fact designated historic. So what's this mean for somebody who owns property? Everybody's still subject to the design guidelines and review by the commission, but there are stricter guidelines for those properties designated as historic. So these additional 38 would be looked at more closely with any future changes that might be proposed. So things like windows and doors, retaining originals, forms, it just steps up, it increases the level of review for those kinds of activities. On the other hand, a property owner who does renovate, rehabilitate a designated historic property can do an income tax credit of up to 25% on their income taxes at the state level for taking care of and making improvements to an historic structure. So there are financial benefits to somebody being able to do that. And in the case of demolitions, these get looked at much more closely with an eye towards preserving, if at all possible. But ultimately, the commission could look at it and say, I mean, there's no way to save this one. It's, you know, degraded or whatever. And we would agree with the property owner that they could remove it. All property owners were notified of those meetings. Those were divvied up into four over the course of late summer, early fall. And so the property owners themselves received a letter saying this is under consideration. And we also mailed certified letters to those 38 property owners in advance of this public hearing. And there are about 100 other slides behind here that show you each one of those 38 properties. And we just will have those available for reference. Should somebody speak at your public hearing, we're able to go to each one and get a feel for what are the characteristics, why did the commission recommend designating that particular property. And with that, I'll quit and see if there are questions that you have, or if there's additional information that you'd like to see as we get set up for that hearing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alma. Committee, any questions? Ms. Corley?
Homeowners would have a process to appeal, right?
Yes, so as part of this process, they could stand up and make comment to you, and you might decide as a council, we're going to put 20 of them and actually designate, after you're done, you may pick and choose and say, somebody made a good case that this particular one we don't agree with. You might say 20 we'll add and 18 we won't. So that's what you'll do after we move through that process.
Mr. Chapman?
Mr. Alma, are all of the properties that are on the National Register included already in this district?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. That would be important to me.
Is Alhambra on the National?
Requested.
It's been requested. So even our own Alhambra Hall would be a local historic designation. But I think we've included, the others have already been included.
Okay.
Mrs. Hyatt?
What are the parameters for them to decide what to put on this list? It's completely subjective. I mean, they just look at it and say, I mean, I understand the year, but what else is involved?
You have to do a specific inventory following guidelines put forth by the State Historic Preservation Office on how you do an inventory and what you look for. That was all done in 2010, and we just brought it up to date, taking a look at it. In the intervening decade, there may have been something that was inventoried in 2010 that said this one could qualify back then, but in the interim, additions have occurred or changes have been made, and the staff would have looked at that and said, it's no longer, you know, valid for inclusion. And that recommendation would have been given to the commission. So they saw all 1,158 and recommended that only 38 move forward. But you have to go through a specific process of identifying and assessing properties in order to, you know, first determine their eligibility to be an historic structure or historic property.
Because as the years move forward, like you're saying, we're into the 70s now, we're not going to see the same architecturally, we're not going to see what we saw in 1910. So I'm just trying to figure out what they are
using to judge. And that's where, yes, your guidelines need to be updated and continually changed as things, you know, move forward. It could be, you know, architectural periods that exist, or, you know, the character of that we would want to update and include in those things that contribute to making that particular district historic. Alternatively, you may say there's an area just outside of that, for instance, as you move away, that exhibits those characteristics of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and we would like to create a separate historic district for that. Council could do that, and it would have its own, you would obviously be looking at 1960s ranches differently than you would be looking at 1890 Victorians, and so yeah, there may be a need in the future to consider you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that there would be different parameters, and you know, there are things about mid-century worth preserving, I feel, in our, rather than just the old village part, we still have the older part of Mount Pleasant that nobody seems to be preserving.
Right.
Everybody's tearing them down and building things. So
in effect,
that's being considered.
We have one zoning district overlay that's historic, which was the old village as it was established in 79. And so there have been discussions. The comp plan recommends looking at potentially expanding that district some. But again, you're going to run into different architectural styles and things that might suggest not including it in the old village overlay, but creating another one with a different...
Old Mount Pleasant.
Old Mount Pleasant historic district. And remember, we wrote this so that it could be broad enough that there could be a settlement community area that's part of the town that you might create, again, a separate district with its own standards and guidelines for how to maintain the character and attributes of that particular area that are not going to be the same as within the old village. We got one, we have one size right now, but someday you could have multiples.
And of the 38 homeowners who've been notified, have we heard back from some of them as to their thoughts on being designated historic? I know we've gotten a couple emails, but that's just from council. I'm not sure if you all have gotten more.
We've had mostly just inquiries from folks. So they were aware of the commission doing its work through their prior meetings. And so still, I know of a couple of conversations where folks are just explaining to me again what this means and how do you distinguish. And it is confusing with National Register or, you know, national sites versus local zoning, and so more, it seems to be more of a just the getting the information. I've not heard of any where anybody's been vehemently opposed saying don't include my particular property, but they may be saving that to share with you.
Okay,
but
all right, thank you.
It appeared that the commission did a good job of really paying attention to making a recommendation to you that was sound with those that ought to be considered.
All right, thank you. Do we have any other questions? All right, moving on to the next item on the agenda. This is a status report on the zoning code rewrite.
And I don't know, you don't want me to flip through. Where did it go? Oh, I got close. I think. There, you didn't have to see another 100 slides. As you know, we've been working on an update to the entire zoning code. And actually that was intended to also look at our subdivision regulations, our land development regulations. And we had a consulting team that we've hired, White and Smith, they're local out of Charleston, working on that. We did an audit and we shared that with the committee in August and Planning Commission in July, where there were a whole series of recommendations on how to proceed. And based on that, we have extended the contract with White and Smith, and we're now moving into what we're calling the phase one process. And so you see it here graphically, basically including a couple of sort of modules that we'll be working on. The top one is throughout the entire process, it'll be working on format, laying it out, references, all of those kinds of things. That's kind of like boilerplate. Another early aspect that we want to tackle is the Shem Creek waterfront district. And this would specifically be designed to deal with the special area plan that was adopted previously or accepted previously. And now you have a plan, but our zoning doesn't help you accomplish that plan. And there are a lot of issues along the waterfront with nonconformities or uses or other kinds of things. So that would be a key piece that this first round of amendments would bring forward. It kind of take it out of sequence and go ahead and let you could conceivably adopt that in advance of the whole rest of the zoning code being updated. And then there are a couple others that we want to look at as well. Those would include conflicts. So we talk about the comp plan and the boulevard overlay and our hub areas. We need to fix that zoning. You just heard Michelle earlier talk about automatically people are zoned R1, which may, I mean, that's just the way our ordinance is spelled out today. That could easily be fixed. And we have different ways in the comp plan of designating properties as opposed to the ordinance. So there are a series of those kinds of conflicts between the new plan and our old zoning that need to be cleaned up. And then there are just a couple others that we give you as examples here of some that are really tough to deal with. The whole arena of vested rights, which you'll see in a second, is one that just needs a lot of work with us, and it's very confusing and probably covers 20 pages in the ordinance of sorting out what's vested and how long can you continue to proceed with the project before you have to meet today's regulations. Another one that we've talked about are tree preservation, and this one may not work. No, it didn't. Our tree preservation requirements on single individual lots. We know we have all of, you know, the major developments as they're working is one thing, but you have, you know, individual property owners constantly, daily, working with the department, working with the staff on whether or not they can remove, you know, one tree. And for a variety of reasons, the chart was to show you the scale 10 years ago. Over the past 10 years, we've gone from a couple hundred of those individual lot tree removal requests to about 600 a year now. And so the numbers are high, and our resources are pretty much the same. And so are there ways that we could improve the efficacy of the ordinance and be able to, you know, deal with what we can honestly deal with and do a better job of administering that ordinance? And so we would look at things like costs and benefit of regulating to the degree that we do, impacts on resources, cost to property owners. Nobody ever seems to hear these kinds of things, but the cost of removing a large tree and then replanting or paying into the tree bank for that which was removed. I mean, you're talking in the tens of thousands of dollars for some property owners to be able to remove one tree. And it's, you know, there are significant costs. And if they disagree with the staff interpretation, they also have to go through the BOZA process. And then sometimes the way the ordinance is written, it says you need to mitigate and plant X number of 4-inch trees, but I don't have the room on the lot to even do it. And then I have to pay into the tree bank. And it's kind of a, it's a difficult process, again, from a resource standpoint and from a benefit standpoint. Is there a better way that we could be achieving some of these same objectives without having to handle 600 permit application requests a year? And so that would be the kind of thing that would be also accelerated and worked on so we can clean that up as this process moves forward. And the pieces that we'd like to work on first, estimated roughly we'd be in a position to probably be here in front of this committee in October of 2021.
All right.
And that's the zoning code update.
Thank you. Do we have any questions?
I'm leaving it in your good hands.
Any questions or thoughts from the committee?
Thank you. Yeah. With the tree, I mean, you're not talking about, you're talking about making it easier for a homeowner to get rid of a tree?
Not necessarily. It's just what are our requirements, or, you know, what are the ways, or is the mitigation, are the mitigation levels too high? Our ordinance before, as I understand it, was a little simpler. And so there, you know, there may be ways to, you know, deal with the ordinance and account for things that we didn't account for in the current process.
You guys remember you got some trees.
I mean, the whole objective is still retaining and maintaining trees and tree cover.
Yeah.
But are we sort of, is it overkill for what we're getting? We find many communities across the country maintain as many trees as we have here in Mount Pleasant, and they do not, they totally exempt single family residential tree removals. And so you've got this spectrum of, you know, this entire range. Is there something a little bit easier for us to administer that can still achieve those same objectives? So it wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't be issuing chainsaws in
yes.
lieu of submitting for a permit.
No. Just remember who you're talking to.
Pardon?
Well, that hugging a tree.
Hugging a tree.
Ms. Hyatt?
I guess she asked part of what I was going to say. I guess with rewriting the zoning code, there's no need for council to be involved in any way other than just hearing it when it happens and then we're just yes or no, or, I mean.
The way we set it up is that as we move forward, there's an expectation that pieces would be brought through committee and shared with you, and the ability to massage that or redirect that would occur along the way. You don't want to wait until the entire thing is all rewritten and then find out what, you know, why are we going this way when we wanted to go that way?
Right.
So it'd be keeping you informed along the way.
That's great. Well, I just think we all would like to see something before October or see like the progress.
And that's only part of it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, typically these projects take 3 or 4 years to rewrite a whole zoning code.
Is it like a comp plan?
If you're a community of more than 10,000 people, it takes a little while.
Mr. Chapman, did you have anything?
No, ma'am.
All right. Moving on.
I have to say, isn't it, we got one more item, is to thank Mr. Ulmer for all of his years of work. This is his last visit to our committee. Obviously, he will be at the council meeting next Tuesday, but this is his last presentation for our committee, and I'd like to thank him for all of his hard work and wish him the best in his retirement.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I may show up for my 2 minutes here, so you'll be seeing you'll be seeing me in the future. This last item is a request from Legacy at Patriots Point. This is the apartment complex at the corner of Harry Hallman and Patriots Point Boulevard, next to the Shriners building. This project has been moving along and has certain vested rights, and you start with a 2-year vested rights period, and then you can get 5 individual 1-year extensions. This is the second request for a 1-year extension on this project. And if ordinances haven't changed, which they haven't, that affect this property, council is obligated to approve that extension. It's almost a rote kind of step that you have to do, but we have to share that with you and council. You'll be seeing that at this particular one again for another 1-year extension at your meeting next week.
And so we don't need a motion or a recommendation because this is just sort of something we are required to do.
Yeah, okay. You get to deal with it. And it is part of the Bridgeside development and a very long history. And again, this is actually their third 1-year extension. So they'd be slowly running out of time eventually, and so they need to move forward with the construction. They do have foundation permit and, you know, approvals to begin moving forward, and I think it's about 175 apartments at that location, which predate they're vested for a reason, and they predate our other provisions like the moratorium and building permit allocation system. Although, no, they were part of the building permit allocation. They spoke for part of those 500 that I mentioned earlier today.
Mm. All right. Any thoughts on this? No? All right. That is the last item on the agenda. There's nothing more to come before this committee. We are adjourned.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's like we can only turn back time.